Good afternoon, and welcome to KALW's Open Air, our weekly magazine of most things culturally considered. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. This week, a live studio performance by the Galax Quartet with contralto Karen Clark. They're performing this weekend under the auspices of the San Francisco Early Music Society. Russian pianist Daniil Trivanov shares some details about his performances this week with the San Francisco Symphony. Plus, Diane Keough offers her take on some recent cultural happenings, and Peter Robbins will also be in. He covers the latest filmed Jack Ryan thriller and offers a personal memory of his encounter with Pete Seeger. Stay tuned. The San Francisco Early Music Society presents the Galax Quartet with contralto Karen Clark in Chromatic Clusters, a program that pairs avant-garde music from the 16th century with new music, including the world premiere of Roy Weldon, who also plays viola da gamba in the group. Also on the program, On the Petaluma River, and the West Coast premiere of Joseph Schwantner's Dream Drapery, Thoreau Songs. Karen Clark and the Galax Quartet in concert now, and then we'll talk with them on Open Air.
Thank you.
Galax Quartet, performing live in studio with contralto Karen Clark here on Open Air. The Galax Quartet is Elizabeth Blumenstock on violin, David Morris on cello, Roy Weldon on viola da gamba, who also is contributing to the program in a work of his own, and David Wilson on violin and viola. Again, Karen Clark, the beautiful sounds of Karen Clark there for you to enjoy. Karen, I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit about this amazing piece you just sang a part of, the Orlando de Lasso.
Well, probably the most obvious amazing thing about it is the chromaticism, and it's a little bit hard to understand. Orlando de Lasso wrote this as a gift for Albrecht V of Bavaria. So it was a gift, and based on, it's a compilation of really a cycle of 12 motets that prophesy foretell the virgin birth of Christ. And but he put it in a context going that harkens back to antiquity, where the tradition of sibyls, in fact, they're known. The sibyls are known. There's the first one is from Persica, from Libica, and in the manuscript, which actually is housed in Vienna, there were woodcuts that were done showing the actual a sibyl, and it's even known what their age was and what significance that carries in terms of these motets for Orlando de Lasso. So they're a little bit more than a little bit mystical, and a little bit the actual sibyl herself doesn't seem to have so much to do with what the actual text is saying, but most of the texts have to do with the virgin birth.
Is it very difficult performing something that is that chromatic? It's an extraordinarily chromatic piece.
Well, you know, I mean, maybe it's difficult, but it's also really fun. And I think that what we chose to do this on this program, because we're also doing, of course, Joseph Schwantner's new piece, which is 21st Century, was actually composed for us. We actually did the world premiere in the Midwest in 2011. And so we're excited that this is its actual West Coast premiere. But we wanted to put these together because the chromaticism of the late Renaissance and then the chromaticism, actually, to my mind, the Schwantner is a little more melodic in terms of understanding the harmonies or what's going on. I mean, it's very interesting.
That's Karen Clark. She's performing with the Galax Quartet under the auspices of the San Francisco Early Music Society. Concerts on Friday in Palo Alto, Saturday in Berkeley, and Sunday in San Francisco. The Galax Quartet, as I mentioned, Elizabeth Blumenstock on violin, David Morris cello, Roy Weldon viola da gamba, and David Wilson violin and viola. To the quartet, how did you decide to move into this repertory instead of something that's more contemporary? How did this particular quartet form?
That's a very easily answered
This is
question.
Roy Weldon.
This is Roy. This is an existing ensemble from the 18th century, end of the 18th century. So when Haydn was writing his quartets, Abel, Carl Friedrich Abel, the last of the viola da gamba players, was writing quartets in England. In fact, he had the first published set of quartets, 1869, I think. 1769. Unfortunately, there are only two pieces that exist for this combination of instruments. And
We should mention this particular ensemble is using two violins. You're playing viola da gamba and cello.
And cello.
So only two pieces.
There are only two pieces. So we're more or less forced to commission new music.
Roy, could you tell us a little bit about, since this is an audible medium and not a visual medium, what is the viola da gamba and its history, and describe for our listeners what it actually looks like. It's more more strings than a cello.
It is. It has six strings, so it's more closely related to the lute family, the guitar family. It's not a forerunner of the cello.
Despite of it looking very much like a cello.
Yeah, right. It's about the same size as a cello. Mm-hmm. Almost the same range. one big difference is the way the bow is held. I bow everything underhanded and in reverse direction from the others.
Mm-hmm. I should mention that it's held between your legs. There's no peg like a cello would have either.
To
rest on the ground.
In fact, none of us uses any kind of a spike or end pin because they just weren't in use during Hubble's time. And so these instruments are just resting on our calves.
Oh, okay.
And if I pluck the open strings, here's the cello. It's just a giant violin tuned in fifths. Here's the viola da gamba.
Yes, very much more of the guitar family.
Exactly.
I should mention that it is a fretted instrument as well.
It is partially fretted. Yes.
Partially fretted. So could you give us a little bit of example of the range of the viola da gamba?
Oh, sure. Here's a typical chord.
And David, so we get this early cello in our hand.
Cello's got a just more solid, meatier, solid, but they work well together. And I also happen to play gamba, so I know how to blend into that sound a little more.
Wonderful. Roy, also on this program is a work of yours. I'm wondering if you could tell me a little bit about the inspiration for the work of yours that's on the program, on the Petaluma River. I imagine the Petaluma River had something to do with the inspiration.
Yes, it does. There's a poem by Gary Snyder, which I've loved. The poem talks about the death of his sister on Route 101 near the Petaluma River as she's going to serve jury duty. This happened about 12 years ago, I believe. And it's a very sad poem, and I was inspired to write something in a similar vein, without being too descriptive or literal about the events of this particular poem.
And your writing style, who do you find as inspiration for your writing in terms of your musical style?
Okay, well, for this particular piece, which you're not playing now, but we will play it on the weekend, I've long admired the works of Webern, Anton Webern. I love his quietness, his silences. I've tried to write something in that vein for about 40 years now, and so in a sense I've thought about this piece for a long time, and that's the direction I took this piece.
Ed, will you be playing viola da gamba for that work as well?
Yes.
Wonderful. Also on the program is, we heard some of the Di Lasso earlier, some music of Gesualdo, also a very chromatic early composer living from 1566 to 1613, and Dream Drapery, a work called Thoreau, be the West Coast premiere of Joseph Schwantner's Dream Drapery Thoreau songs. I'm wondering if you could tell, we are going to hear a little bit of the Schwantner momentarily, but can we talk about Schwantner's work a little bit in terms of his inspiration for the Thoreau? What are the Thoreau songs that are being used?
Joseph Schwantner.
This is Karen Clark.
Actually, he's won a couple of Grammys, and most recently, it was a couple years ago, for his symphonic work for percussion. And he's done, in recent years, mostly symphonic or more orchestral types of compositions. But he is known for having written song cycles, for instance, for Lucy Shelton, a New York-based recital and new music advocate and friend of his. And so we asked him if he would consider writing a song cycle for us, and he happily agreed and wanted to do on poems of Thoreau. So these were actually his choosing of the poems. And as most people we talk to, they don't think of Thoreau as a poet, but there are poems that show up if you read through his writings. So these are those.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Could you speak the words of the song we're going to hear first?
Oh, sure. The willows droop, the alders stoop, the pheasants group beneath the snow. The fishes glide from side to side in the clear tide, the ice below. The ferret weeps, the marmot sleeps, the owlet keeps in his snug nook. The rabbit leaps, the mouse out creeps, the flag out peeps beside the brook. And so on. Uh-huh. There are a few more words to that. And then at the end, he has me actually ending with recitation. And I'll tell you, in learning this, I was inspired in my own little personal journal to draw little pictures of the scene. So it's very pictorial, this one.
Ah, I see. I'm very curious as to how Schwantner said it. I'll let you guys do another retuning if you'd like to.
I might also say that I play tuned crystal goblets for this one.
All right.
So I hope I can get them going. While you tune, I'm going to try to get them going.
And are those goblets in a particular tone that you've chosen?
Yes, A and E.
A and E. Mm-hmm. It looks like is the A the wine glass?
Baroque pitch. Uh-huh, yes. Oh, right there. Okay.
I could say just a word about
that.
Sure.
The song that we're about to do is among the more rhythmic and sharp-edged of the pieces in the cycle, and Schwantner uses ostinato, which is a rhythmic or melodic pattern which repeats over and over again. He uses that a lot. You'll hear that in this piece, but elsewhere in the cycle, songs that you'll hear us play this weekend, he's very fond of a musical texture where a melody floats or soars or is rich or whatever above a very sort of misty kind of texture with the rhythms are very carefully notated in our parts, but they're deliberately sort of overlapping so that it's very very ethereal sounding, a very lovely sound. It's the sort of thing that when I listen to it, I think, wow, that's really beautiful, and when I'm playing it, I'm counting 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. 1, 2.
Yeah, that's David Wilson playing and counting on his violin with David Morris on cello, Roy Weldon viola da gamba, and Elizabeth Blumenstock violin. They are the Galax Quartet, performing with contralto Karen Clark, and now live in studio here at KLW, an excerpt from Joseph Schwantner's Dream Drapery, Thoreau songs.
This is the fourth song in the song cycle. The title is A Winter and Spring Scene.
Fishes glide from side to side in the clear tide, the ice below. The ferret weeps, the marmot sleeps, the owlet keeps in his snug nook. The rabbit leaps, the mouse out creeps, the flag out peeps beside the brook. trench calls for in the wood. The traveler dreams, the hot tree ice gleams, the blue jay screams in angry mood. The apples thaw, the ravens call, the squirrels gnaw, the frozen fruit to their retreat. I track the feet of mice that eat the apple's root. Treacherous knows his tracks behind. Now melts the snow in the warm sun. The meadows flow, the streamlets run. The spring is born. The wild bees bum. The insects hum and trees drop gum. And winter's gone and summer's come. The chickadee lisps in the tree. The winter bee not fearing frost. The small nuthatch, the bark doth scratch, some worm to catch at any cost.
Live in studio, an excerpt from Joseph Schwantner's Dream Drapery, Thoreau Songs. Karen Clark with the Galax Quartet. Karen, who was called singing throaty singing hints of modernist extravagance and medieval troubadours by none other than Joshua Cosman, who will be my guest as usual for the first Thursday of the month next week to share his picks. Beautiful, beautiful singing.
Thank you very much.
And a fantastic program in store for you if you are able to attend the San Francisco Early Music Society's presenting the Galax Quartet with Karen Clark in Chromatic Clusters, music from the avant-garde 16th century with new music, including the world premiere of Roy Weldon's On the Petaluma River, and just a tease there of Joseph Schwantner's Dream Drapery, Thoreau Songs. Where, you may ask? Well, tomorrow is in Palo Alto at the First Lutheran Church, Saturday in Berkeley at St. John's Presby, and Sunday here in San Francisco at St. Mark's Lutheran Church. Tickets and information at the San Francisco Early Music Society website, sfems.org. To the quartet, I thank you so much for performing live in this rather interesting studio setup. And Karen, again, just wonderful having you
here. Thank you for having us.
Pianist Daniil Trifonov is performing with the San Francisco Symphony this week. We'll be hearing some an interview I taped earlier with him. Let's hear a little bit of music of Mr. Trifonov. excerpt from Chopin's Impromptu in A-flat Major, Opus 29. Daniil Trifonov at the piano. Daniil, welcome to KLW.
Hello.
What sort of a performance schedule are you keeping now that you've won so many competitions and had such accolades around the world?
Well, nowadays it's roughly around 100 concerts per year. Of course, I have been playing concerts before, and even when I was a kid, I was already playing some concerts. But of course, my career went on completely different dimension after the competitions. Well, it is considered among the most respected competitions, primarily due to the also the winners which have been in the past of these competitions. The first one was Van Cliburn, and there was other amazing pianists such as Grigory Sokolov and Mikhail Pletnyov, Vladimir Ashkenazy.
So at this stage, now that you're doing all of this performing, 100 performances a year, is that where your concentration is now instead of another sort of competition?
Certainly, as my concert life started to be very active, I'm now not anymore planning to participate in any more competitions, but now there is our challenge to find enough free time. Because I'm also, for example, I'm really enjoying composing music, and it's not easy to combine it with touring. So every time I have some spot for vacations, I dedicate a lot of time for it.
Are you writing for piano or for orchestra or chamber group?
Most of the time I write for piano, but now there is a piano concerto for piano and orchestra coming up, and I'm just finishing I'm finishing orchestration process of it. So the premiere will be in April.
So we mentioned how little downtime do you have. When you're visiting all of these cities, do you get any time off to explore the cities that you're visiting?
Well, depends on the free time. Of course, I try to. It's always interesting to visit some new exhibition or just to walk and see the beauty of a place, or even attend other performances if they are scheduled.
This is your second visit to San Francisco as a performer. You were at Davies Hall last February with the Russian National Orchestra performing Prokofiev's Piano Concerto No. 3, as well as Tchaikovsky's Piano Concerto No. 1. And now you're back at Davies Hall performing with the San Francisco Symphony under Vanska. Have you been to San Francisco other than these two times?
I have played a recital, I think 2 years ago in San Francisco, and many, many years ago, when I was still a teenager, there is a Guzik Foundation, which is an organization which is based in California, and it supports the young artists from former Soviet Union countries to have concerts abroad, and also to help studying abroad. So, as part of Guzik Foundation scholarship, I have played with a few other musicians in San Francisco, Los Angeles, Los Angeles.
Oh, nice. Well, how do you like our eclectic San Francisco?
Oh, it's one of the most beautiful cities, not only in the United States, but in general in the world. And it has a very specific, very particular atmosphere, and there is a lot of places to visit.
Well, hopefully you can spend a little bit more time next time you come.
Well, I hope to spend enough time also during this visit.
Good, good. Now, I do want to talk a little bit about your growing up. I mean, at 22 now, having racked up all of these competitions, you must have started at a very early age on the piano, but did you have any time for more of a classical education in other areas than music, or was it strictly music when you were growing up?
Oh, no. It was a very intensive education back in, I remember when I was in Moscow at Gnesin School, we had everything. We had even psychology and philosophy and chemistry and physics, maths, of course, all the Russian literature, foreign literature. The only problem that we didn't study in depth English language for. So, for example, for me, it was quite a challenge after I finished the Gnesin School and went to study in Cleveland. The first half a year, I had to really spend a lot of time learning English.
Well, you're doing quite well.
Thanks.
Now, on your website, you talk about learning from the recorded legacy of older LPs and some of your former teachers that had these recorded of the greats of the golden age of pianists. Who do you consider your inspiration, both historically and who's on the contemporary field?
Well, there are plenty of incredibly inspiring artists from the, both from 20th century and, of course, nowadays. Nowadays, such artists as Marta Argerich, Grigory Sokolov, Radu Lupu. I adore many of their recordings, and among the artists of the past, such as Rachmaninoff and Cortot and Dino Lipatti, Walter Gieseking, Emil Gilels.
So I'm trying to figure out how you have time to even learn of all of these other performers when you're so busy learning your own repertoire.
Well, no, but I'm also listening to symphonies and operas always. Sometimes flights can be quite long, and it's a very good place to listen to music.
You also wrote that when you play a certain composer, it changes you as a musician. So what effect has Rachmaninoff had on you?
Well, it also depends which piece. As, for example, with Rhapsody in Time of Paganini, it's a very also untraditional piece for Rachmaninoff, as he was finding a lot of new elements in his language, and this is quite late work of his, and you can see changes of his concept of treating a musical material, as this is probably his most philosophic work so far in his heritage. Questions raised about the society and about the destiny of art, and how art can influence in a good or in a bad way the humanity.
That's a wonderful piece of music, and you got a great ensemble to perform it with here with the San Francisco Symphony, that's for sure. Is there a particular work you're looking forward to learning as a new work?
Well, there are plenty of projects of a new repertoire, and among them new concerti and new solo programs and chamber music as well.
I'm sure you'll make some time, and maybe you'll be back to perform a concerto of your own with the symphony at some day.
Yeah, it's actually the premiere of a concerto is already scheduled. This will be in April in Cleveland.
Well, we'll look out for that. Daniel, thank you for taking some time today.
Thank you.
Daniel Trifonov is performing the Rachmaninoff Rhapsody on a theme of Paganini with the San Francisco Symphony under guest conductor Osmo Vanska. Also on the program, music of Sibelius, his interesting Night Ride and Sunrise, as well as Stravinsky's Symphonies of Wind Instruments, Sibelius's Symphony No. 6. Information and tickets at sfsymphony.org. Performances get underway just after today's show and then on Friday evening and Saturday evening. Again, information at sfsymphony.org. Daniel also has a new CD out on Deutsche Grammophon called the Carnegie Recital, so check that out in stores now or online through your iTunes. Here's more music of Daniel Trifonov performing the Tarantella in A-flat major. Chopin's Tarantella in A-flat major, Opus 43, Daniel Trifonov, tickling the ivories there. Still to come, Peter Robinson shares a memory of Pete Seeger, as well as a movie review or two. And next, both critics at large in studio today. Diane Keough joins us once again in studio. Hi, Diane.
Hi, David.
What you been up to?
Well, I've been up to a lot of things, but I have to say one thing first, David. I went to the symphony, the Peninsula Symphony, and I always come early so I can listen to you discuss things with things. That happened to be Taylor Eichsti that night. He was fabulous.
He really was something.
Neat kid. But what I think everybody doesn't know, and I just told Matt because he didn't know, you're a singer.
I try.
You did. You got up there and you sang two Gershwin songs, and your voice was fabulous. How come I've known you all these years and I didn't know you could sing?
Well, I had an incredible accompanist in the form of Taylor Eichsing. We did not rehearse that at all.
Oh, you didn't?
And I just wanted to share as part of the pre-talk, you know, the words of Ira Gershwin.
Right.
You're doing all this Gershwin.
Right, because you did all the choruses.
Yeah.
And anyway, I just want everybody to know you're a great singer. And I heard the woman next to me kept saying, gosh, he's got such great stage presence. And I thought, well, that would be a nice thing for you to know, too.
You're very kind. That was totally unexpected.
I know it was. So anyway, I've been to a couple of plays, which I'd like to talk about. I've been to one movie, and we have an art museum opening. So I'll go with the plays first, and I think we'll hit with The Grapes of Wrath, which is probably one of the America's finest authors, John Steinbeck. And everybody knows it's set during the Depression, based on the Jode family. But the thing that, and I don't think I have to go into the story on it, the thing that amazed me, there were 22 people in the cast. It was at Hilborn Theater. And I can't tell you that there was one actor that was not excellent in the entire production. It was so good that if you walked out of there and didn't have a tear in your eye, you were dead. Because it was, the emotions were great, the acting was fabulous. And so that's at the Hilborn Theater, and it's going to be there until February 9th.
Tickets and information at Hilborn Theater, R-E Theater, hilborntheater.org.
Yes. The other one was a very interesting one, Silent Sky, and that's at Theater Works in Mountain View. It's written by Lauren Gunderson, and it's the true story of Henrietta Leavitt, an early 20th century astronomer, a female, who was much more interested in the stars than any other womanly pursuits.
In fact, I had Lauren on Open Air a couple weeks ago. Yeah, fascinating story. I'm looking forward to seeing it. So tell me what you saw.
Well, it's great. It is a story of this wonderful girl who's living in Massachusetts and looks at the stars every night in a silent way, and that's why it's Silent Sky. But the theater itself is great, the way they put the production together. It feels good. It feels like you're looking through the thing at the sky and the stars. But it shows the story of a girl who was much more interested in the stars than anything else. She wanted so badly to go to Harvard and be part of that group that was there. She got there, ultimately. She discovered some things that made the Hubble telescope possible, which is amazing when you think about it. And I don't want to go into any more detail on the play, but there are some really funny lines in it. They're just hysterically funny. Gunderson is a great, great writer,
wow.
I thought.
I'm looking forward to that then.
And
too, yeah.
It's a lot of fun. It's very interesting. And I thought, oh, well, who cares about, you know, an astronomer and all this other stuff? They made it so interesting that you understood what they were talking about. There's a little love stuff going on in there. There she gets ill at the end. But the story altogether is so well done. And talk me something I didn't know. I went to look it up on Google, and there is line after line after line about Henrietta Leavitt. So it's really excellent. Now,
well, let me tell you, once again, that's tonight, tomorrow, and this weekend at Theater Works at the Mountain View Center for the Performing Arts on Castro Street in Mountain View. Tickets and information at theaterworks.org. Again, people spelling theater the British way.
They all do now.
Theaterworks.org.
R-E. I always thought it was an affectation, but I guess it's just done this way.
Silent Sky. Go see it.
Yeah. Now, on the other hand, there's a movie out there called Inside Llewyn Davis. I don't know what to say about it other than it's a movie about nothing, basically.
Well, it's a Coen Brothers film, so there's got to be something in there.
Well, it's not a comedy, and they had it in the comedy sense because it isn't. There's a couple of funny lines, but it's really about... It opens with Oscar... Oh, gosh, I can't remember. Oscar Isaacs singing.
Mm-hmm.
And he's a good singer. He's a folk singer. He wears a scruffy old jacket and a scarf around his neck and a scuffy old beard, and he doesn't have any money, he doesn't have any place to live, but he's working for his quote art unquote, and when he's offered things, he won't take them because it's not the way he wants to be. And it's so narrow, and it's so narrowly confined that even the hallways are so narrow that two people can't go down them at the same time. The doorways are so narrow that you couldn't get a couch in, and the beds that he sleeps on all over town are so short that he's too long for the beds. So it kind of gives you a view of his life. It's very narrow, it's very small, and it's all about him. every bit of it.
John
Goodman.
John Goodman. I was going to say John Goodman also in the cast.
Such a fabulous part he played. He was so awful in it, but he was good awful.
Yeah.
And some of his lines were very funny. I didn't realize. I mean, it was so hard to take when you. I'm not going to tell that part. But,
okay, Goodman also Justin Timberlake,
and Justin Timberlake singing and being one of his best friends. There are a lot of funny parts in it, but it's not a comedy. It's really a black movie, but interesting nonetheless. And it is up for two awards, one for cinematography and sound mixing. And I think that particularly the cinematography would be great. There is a scene where they're driving down. He's driving down in a snowstorm. The windshield wipers are going back and forth, and you hear the ka-tunk, ka-tunk, ka-tunk as they're going over the road. And how many of us have never heard that? And this is on a bleak night in a snowstorm. So, yeah, there's some good parts. And, of course, the marmalade cat that he gets and loses and gets back. And he used eight cats making this during the movie. So it's interesting about the cats, and the cats are not hurt.
Inside Lewin Davis, the Coen Brothers film, rated R in movie theaters all around the Bay Area. Check your local listings.
And one more thing. At the Peninsula Museum of Art, there is a show right now called Old Lovers. And for years, our society treated the subject of old age like some crazy uncle who's got to be kept out of sight at all costs. And now the youth demographic that's always run our country is kind of losing, because the boomers are in the doorway and passing through that doorway into senior citizenhood. So a slight change.
What'd you say? What?
What? Who?
What? Where are my reading glasses?
So a slight change is going to come. But for 40 years, Eleanor Dickinson has done a series of drawing of old lovers. They're elegant, incisive, brutally honest, and borderline unsalable because of what they are. They are anything but pornographic. They show the love and the caring of couples that are well past their prime in life. And on the wall next to it, she has the people's names and the dates that they used when she drew these things. And she says that they were so apologetic about their bodies. And she said, don't be. This is the way it is. She's done some beautiful work. It's at the Peninsula Museum of Art, and it will be there for a while. There are a couple of other things going on at the same time. Savage Garden by Kalani Engels and Tobias Tavera Hermetica with some paintings. But
so it sounds like your dance card has been quite full. Good for you.
It has been, and I hope it's full again coming soon.
Well, thanks for sharing that. Again, the Peninsula Museum can be previewed at peninsulamuseum.org. Diane, thanks for sharing your latest exploits here.
It's been great.
Welcoming now back Peter Robinson to the mic to share a couple of movie reviews, as well as to talk about his relationship with Pete Seeger. Mr. Robinson, welcome back to the airwaves.
Hi, David. Good to be here. And pleased you're not singing today. I didn't realize. And do you dance? That is the question.
No, the dance thing, definitely not.
Okay. Well, for spy buffs, you'll be glad to hear that Jack Ryan is back in business. And Jack Ryan, of course, was the hero of many a Tom Clancy novel, a spy thriller novel. And what they have done now, because Clancy died last year, is introduce a young Jack Ryan. In fact, he's just being initiated into the CIA. So after a 12-year absence, Jack Ryan is on the screen. He's played by Chris Pine. And this story, once again, I think makes a good job at updating the traditional Cold War spy thriller. Because what happens with Ryan is that he is recruited by nobody less than Kevin Costner, who's now recruiting for the CIA as the control, and he is catapulted eventually via Wall Street into Moscow. Now, why do I say via Wall Street? Well, it seems that basic training for all CIA agents nowadays is to become some type of compliance officer in the banking industry. So we are looking at bringing down the almighty dollar. This is a spy thriller about economic warfare, and it has a very beautiful lady on the side, Keira Knightley. So if you're looking for eye candy, here she is, and she trains Jack Ryan not in spying, but how to walk again. Because the opening scenes take place in Afghanistan. He's in a helicopter which is shot down. He's seriously wounded, and then the story begins in a recovery hospital where she will go out with him once he can run. And of course, run he does. He's recruited into the agency, he's shot over to Moscow, and who should we find in Moscow, this time running the Soviet Espionage Brigade, but our old friend Kenneth Branagh. And he does a very, very convincing Russian accent. So we have a story which I think has got some of the harum-scarum chases towards the end, which will bring a kind of dazed look to your eyes. But we've also got a character story as this young and gleeful agent sets about essentially saving America from an economic disaster. Of course, you may well ask, if the Russians collapse from inside, maybe we don't need the Russians to help us collapse from within. And we look at the mortgage situation, the horrors of Wall Street, and we say, well, maybe we can do it all by ourselves.
Chris Pine as Jack Ryan.
That's right. So I highly recommend this. It's a fast-moving thriller, well worth seeing, and running at cinemas in Marin, in San Francisco, and in the East Bay. Now, my second recommendation is something which is a little harder to find. It is a wonderful and worthwhile documentary. It's called The Girls in the Band. And this is based on the great bands of the 1930s and 1940s, where it was very hard for female musicians, horn players, pianists, to actually get a look in. But they did get a look in, and they did join some of the big bands, including people like Tommy Dorsey. And this is their story. So the film is well cut, well put together, with a lot of great musical shots, and it does explain how, from the 1930s, then through the Second World War, these girls not only played in bands, but eventually ended up creating a band of their own. It's a wonderful, wonderful musical documentary. It's great storytelling, and I think it contributes both to the history of music and, in its own way, to the history of feminism, because this was not an easy road to follow. Towards the end, the ladies now, who are often in their 80s, the ones who have lived and survived during this era, are giving memories with cuts from the pieces that they used to play. And in some instances, as one of them says, traveling south was something we all wanted to forget, because a person like Clara Bryant, a self-described Trumpist, had problems with what was then in legislation in the South, the Jim Crow laws, where, again, mixed bands of mixed races were very hard to get bookings. So I highly recommend this. It's playing in the San Rafael, at the San Rafael Theatre. It is not going to have a long-lasting life, because documentaries, unfortunately, unlike big movie titles, don't stay long.
It's also at the Landmarks Opera Plaza here in San Francisco, just through today.
So
last showtimes, if you want to catch it here in San Francisco.
Okay, so you have tonight for a roll on the drums, a toot on the horn, a roll on the piano. Yes, it's The Girls in the Band, highly recommended for jazz buffs and for social historians who want essentially to learn about a little bit of jazz history that maybe some of the stories haven't yet emerged. Well, I was going to go on, but first let me see whether we have a track of music to go with us. And it's an old song. It's called Goodnight, Irene. I'll say more about it once we hear the lyrics.
Irene, good night, Irene, good night. Good night, Irene, good night, Irene. I'll see you in my dream. Sometimes I live in the country, sometimes I live in town. Sometimes I take a great notion to jump into the river and drown.
Well, that is a song you can just keep humming, and I'm going to hum it all the way back to San Francisco. Of course, it is the immortal but now gone Pete Seeger. And what it does for me is conjure up a interesting memory, because the song first came out in the 1950s. It had been popular during the war, but there was great revival in the 50s. And he would make that transition from what he really didn't care too much for, which was Tin Pan Alley, to the whole era of folk music. And I met him for the very first time in Washington in November 1969. It was one of those protests, one of the key protests against the war in Vietnam. And we had met in a small cafe in Georgetown on a very, very chilly November evening. There were many students there, and the press were gathered round. And I think my first memory of Pete Seeger is the smile. There was something warmth about the way he opened up to interviews. He thought I'd actually come all the way from London for the interview. In fact, I was already teaching down at the University of Florida, and was doing my best, or my part, to help the war protest movement. The other thing which comes across from him, because he is a great storyteller, he's a poet, as well as obviously being a musician, and above all a banjo plucker, either, is the belief that you can hear through your ears, but you can sing through your mouth. And I think what he really believed is that music not only transcends borders, transcends frontiers, but it can almost reach those parts of the body that words alone won't do. So when I use the word sing-along, I use it in the best sense. And essentially, if I had to view my understanding of a spiritual guru, it is not somebody on top of a cloud flying high upwards. It's Pete Seeger behind a banjo inviting people in. And I think that is the connection that today with folk music, and often this playing was done with no amplification, it was done spontaneously, and everybody around had their mouth open. And that's what I call the spiritual process, where you reach all parts of the body, you use your ears, you use your mouth, and then you put them to a good cause, whether it's talking union, whether it's all we're saying is give peace a chance, or better still, something which is still with us today, where have all the flowers gone?
Indeed.
And the immortal line, when will we ever learn?
Peter, thank you for sharing that. I think we all, you know, we knew Pete was very old, but I never think would ever lose him. We thought we'd be with him. He'd be with us forever. Mm-hmm. This Saturday, you can hear a special documentary produced by Ben Manila and Devin Strolovich for Seeger's 90th birthday. The documentary features an exclusive interview and, of course, the great music of Pete Seeger, Saturday at 5 on a patchwork quilt here on KALW. Well, I'd like to thank Niels Swinkels for the impressive ballet dancing of musicians and guests on this week's Open Air. But I do want to go out with the music of Pete Seeger. I'm David LaTulipe. You can catch this show as well as past shows at our website, kalw.org. You can send us some show suggestions there as well. Pete Seeger.
Where have all the flowers gone? Long time passing. Where have all the flowers gone? Long time ago. Where have all the flowers gone? The girls have picked them, everyone. Oh, when will you ever learn? Oh, when will you ever learn? Where have all the young girls gone? Long time passing. Where have all the young girls gone? Long time ago. Where have all the young girls gone? They've taken husbands, everyone. Oh, when will you ever learn? Oh, when will you ever learn? young men gone. Long time passing, where have all the young men gone? Long time ago, where have all the young men gone? They're all in uniform. Oh, when will we ever learn? Oh, when will we ever learn?